Hey everybody, and thanks for coming back to another episode of Serial Zombie Mom. So today's episode is going to be multi-parter, so I'm just going to give you guys kind of the warning on that. I'm going to try and keep it a little bit more concise into like two episodes, but I'm really not sure exactly how much content I've got here, and it may stretch out to three. So I'm just going to kind of give you the warning ahead of time and let you know that it might turn into a long one, and this is a bit of a doozy of a case. This is definitely one that's going to get everybody intrigued, and they're going to want to watch the documentaries, and they're going to want to read the books, and they're going to want to, you know, just try and figure out some things for yourself. There's a lot going on here, a lot of things done wrong, and a lot of assumptions made and things like that. So this is a pretty fucked up case. Now, a lot of people have probably heard there was a lot of things going on early to mid, 90s, and the satanic panic that was coming on with Geraldo Rivera and his little Satan worship video that he did about the satanic culture underworld that was all over the U.S. So it's kind of fucked up, kind of weird. But you know, definitely something to go back and look at. I mean, he really just kind of fucked it up for the whole country. Now, this episode, obviously, as well as the next one or possibly two, is based on the West Memphis 3. Now, if you know anything about the West Memphis 3, you know about three boys that were, you know, convicted of a murder that they say they did not commit. So we're going to go through all of this here. Now, I do want to kind of give you guys a bit of a disclaimer. There is a documentary that goes along with this, and viewer discretion is absolutely 100% advised when watching the Paradise Lost documentary, especially that first piece. Initially, in the first few minutes, you're going to be faced with the scene. You're going to be faced with the bodies, and it's really hard to watch, as well as, you know, through the next couple of, you know, parts of the documentary, because they add two other parts to it, and it was supposed to just be one, so later on you see, you know, other parts, and you see actual photos, close-up autopsy photos of the victims, so it's really kind of tough to watch, okay? So I do recommend this documentary. However, it's pretty good. I've watched a couple of others as well, that I'll mention throughout the episodes, but be aware that, like I said, it can be kind of hard to watch. Yeah, it can get pretty rough. Now, I also have read, one book by one of the stepfathers of the victims. And I'll kind of discuss that later. It didn't really give me the answers that I was hoping for, throughout this documentary. So I felt like I wasted a lot of time, reading that book, but I'll kind of get into that, you know, as we go. So on to part one. So really getting into the victims and the start of the timeline and the investigation, as well as a little bit of that satanic panic that was coming. Now, three little boys, 8 years old, got together to ride their bikes. Stevie Branch, Michael Moore, and Christopher Byers were all second graders at Weaver Elementary School, and each had achieved ranks of wolf in their Cub Scout packs. They were best friends and seen together quite often. Like, they all knew each other. The three families all pretty much, like, knew of each other. Maybe had not met each other, but knew of each other. Now, I'm going to talk about each one of the victims. I want to tell you a little bit about each one of them and kind of their home life and things as well. So that's going to take a couple of minutes. But I say that it's pretty necessary to do this and tell you about a little bit about them and their family life. Now, Stevie Branch was the son of Stephen and Pamela Branch, who unfortunately divorced when he was about an infant. Now, Pam got custody and she later remarries. Her new husband is Terry Hobbs. Now, Steve, or Stevie, as they lovingly called him, was an honor student and lived with his mom. We lived with his stepdad and then his 4-year-old sister, Amanda. Christopher Mark Myers was born to Melissa Defer and Ricky Murray. Now, his parents divorced when he was 4, and his mother later remarried to John Mark Byers, who adopted the boy. They lived together with Chris's stepbrother, Sean, who was 13. Now, James Michael Moore was the son of Todd and Dana Moore, and he loved being in the Scouts. He was considered kind of the leader of the 3 boys and lived with his parents and his 9-year-old sister, Dawn. Now, on the afternoon of May 5th, 1993, the boys met up after school and rode off on their bikes. I believe one of the boys, and I'm not sure which one of the boys, did not have a bike, but it was the 3 of them. One rode on the other one's bikes. Like, anyway, they all get together, and Stevie is told by his mother, Pam, you know, be home before 5 so you can have dinner. I've got to go to work. She'll get dropped off after dinner. That was her normal routine. Everyone would eat dinner together, and then they'd go and drop her off at work, and then go amongst their normal stuff. All right. So when he didn't show up at the normal time, just like a normal mom, she's upset. She's pissed. Where the fuck are you? Like, what the hell? You know, he's going to be in so much trouble when he gets home. He's going to get grounded, blah, blah, blah. Now, her husband, Steve's stepfather, Terry Hobbs, rides off to the home of Michael Moore to see if he was over there. When Dana, Michael's mother, says, no, he's not here. You know, they went off together. Like, we're still waiting on Michael to come home. They all start looking around town like, oh, well, you know, he's going to get in so much trouble. He was supposed to be home, you know, whatever. Let's ride around town. We'll find him somewhere. So they start asking around, and then they also run into John Mark Byers and find out that Christopher Byers is missing as well. Knowing that they were all friends, they're like, okay, well, they've got to be somewhere together. Let's just keep looking. They've probably run off to just play and got, you know, carried away and not realize what time it is. So when Steve's mother, Pam, is getting off work, it's like 9 o'clock, okay? They go to get her, and Terry actually has to say, you know, Stevie never came home. We went out searching. We can't find him anywhere, and all the other kids are missing too. So there's a conversation that's had before he goes and picks up the kids, or goes and picks up Pam, sorry, with Dana Moore, which is Michael Moore's mother. And she says, I'm going to go ahead and call the cops, and I'll let them know that, you know, Michael's missing and that Stevie's missing as well. And apparently John Mark Byers, Christopher's father or stepfather, had also already made a phone call. Terry Hobbs makes his phone call at approximately sometime around 9 o'clock at night, stating, you know, he's at the Catfish, or I think it was called the Catfish Island or something like that, the name of the restaurant that Pam worked at. So he calls from the payphone outside and says, you know, yeah, that we've been looking and looking. We can't find them. We don't know where they're at. All 3 of us have been searching. So they all start going around and searching, okay? They can't find them anywhere. So with the cops, you know, then it's like, they're going to start searching. Now, Steve Branch was 8 years old, 4'2", 65 pounds, had blonde hair, and was last seen wearing a white t-shirt and blue jeans, riding a black and red bicycle. Christopher was also 8 years old, 4 foot even, 52 pounds, and had light brown hair. He was last seen wearing jeans, dark shoes, and a long-sleeve white t-shirt. Michael, also 8, was 4'2", 55 pounds, and had brown hair. He was last seen wearing blue pants, a blue Boy Scout shirt, and an orange and blue Boy Scout hat riding a green bicycle. Okay, so that puts Christopher as being the one that's riding on the back of Stevie and Michael's bikes, okay? Now, late this evening, I will say this: there was something that had happened that was kind of questionable, okay? While the families are out looking, while these little boys are already missing, late this evening, sometime around 8-something, and I'll go into more detail a little bit later, but employees at a Bojangles say that a woman and her daughter came running from the bathroom and stated there was an African-American man in the bathroom who was covered in blood and freaking out. They said he had a huge cut on his arm and that his feet were covered in mud, and investigators later investigate and take samples. And we'll discuss, like I said, a little bit more about all of this. But this is just something that happened to happen about that same time frame, and I think it's really important that it's discussed, okay? Now, witnesses allegedly see the boys playing together around 6:30 p.m. And then they see, shortly after, Terry Hobbs calling them to come home. Now, the first report to the police, like I said, was made by John Mark Byers, and this was around 7 p.m. So, you know, the boys had been missing for almost 2 hours. And you know, he wasn't home. Like, no one had come home, and it wasn't like these boys to stay gone that late, that long. Now Terry Hobbs and Michael Moore's mother again called the police about their boys also. Terry calls from his wife's restaurant later that night, as I said, and search goes out with just a few people and a couple of officers. However, they call off the search like crazy fucking early. They're only out there an hour or so, searching and searching. Apparently, it was too hot, and, you know, because it was May, this is, you know, Arkansas, and they were swarmed by mosquitoes. Like, the areas they were going to look for them, it was really, really dense, humid, and they were tons of mosquitoes. So they're like, you know, we're gonna have to stop. We're gonna have to call this off, and we're gonna have to start in the morning, because we cannot, if they haven't shown up, you know, it could be that they're just holed up somewhere, they'll come back in the morning, you know, whatever. So they go back out at 8 o'clock the next morning, okay? The boys haven't turned up. So, 8 a.m. on May 6th, search and rescue personnel come through, and they're like, all right, we're gonna all help. Searchers look all over West Memphis and actually focus mostly on the Robin Hood Hills area where the boys had last been seen. Now, the Robin Hood Hills area was, like, at the end of a neighborhood, and then there was also this big, like, canal drainage ditch thing with some woods around it. Well, and it was common for the kids to go play, you know, and find places to hide and play in there. So apparently the boys had last been seen kind of in that area, so they thought that maybe that might be where they went. They even go shoulder to shoulder to search for these boys, and they find no sign of them. None whatsoever. Now, when the search returns to that Robin Hood Hills area, approximately at 1:45 p.m., juvenile parole officer Steve Jones spots a boy's black shoe floating in a muddy creek that led to the major drainage canal in the Robin Hood Hills. They searched this area once already, quite well, but realized, wait a minute. That shoe wasn't there the last time that we came through here. We know it wasn't, because we looked down and, like we looked and didn't see anything suspicious in the water. But then now there's a little boy's shoe there. What the fuck? And so they're all kind of freaking out, like, something's here. So they search this area, and as they keep searching, they're like, somebody's going to wind up having to get down in the water. Well, Officer Brian Ridge decides, fuck this, Don't worry about it. I'm going to go in with my clothes on and everything. And he goes through and starts wading through the water. Well, he bumps up against something. And when he reaches down to find out what it was, up comes one of the boys' bodies. This was the body of Michael Moore. Now, he lay his body on the bank and then goes back in. In searching the creek, they found the other two boys as well, finding Stevie Branch next, and lastly, Christopher Byers. The two bikes that were missing, as well as the boys, were found at the pipe in which was used as a bridge. The kids would, you know, probably left their bikes right there at the pipe and climbed across it, walked across it, whatever, and went out there to hang out and play. But the bikes were thrown into the water, and they were submerged under this nasty, muddy water. Now, to properly search this area, in their opinion, they dam off the area using, you know, like sandbags, and use a pump to remove a lot of the water that's in that canal, in that drainage ditch. They tape this all off as a crime scene. There is video of Pam Hopps when someone comes up to the cul-de-sac that's right there and say they found his body. That poor woman hits the ground. She screams and hits the ground. You will see these things in these documentaries. You will see this footage of her. And it is the most heartbreaking. And I can't imagine losing a child like that. I can't imagine. It's absolutely heartbreaking. Now, at this point, I'm just going to go ahead and give you guys a major, major, major trigger warning, major disclaimer right now, because I'm kind of going to go through what happened to them or what looked like happened to them. So if you don't want to hear it, or if you think it's going to be too much to handle, you know, skip forward a few minutes, because it's going to take me probably a good 5 minutes to get 4 or 5 minutes to get through this. So it can be pretty disturbing. Now, the boys had been found stripped naked and essentially hogtied with left wrist to left ankle, right wrist to right ankle. But it's a little different, okay? So, like a normal hog tie, all four limbs will meet in the middle, in behind the back, correct? So, in this instance, the four limbs did not meet in the middle. Okay? They were just right to right, left to left, and that was it. But they were tied with their own shoelaces. When watching this documentary, you also see that they were not tied in the way you would expect. It was not the wrist bound to the ankle. Like if you put your hand on your ankle. That's not how they were done. There was a length to the laces, to where actually there was a good foot or more of space between each tie. So between the tie around the ankle and the tie around the wrist. Now, if you watch the documentary, you will be able to see that when you see those little bodies on the bank. And when you see that part in that first couple moments of the documentary, you will see that. And it looks a little awkward. Now, this length to the laces shows they were not tied and pulled behind the back, and not connected literally wrist to ankle, but it was kind of more like they had been set on their knees, like legs bent, sitting on your knees, feet under your butt, and that their arms were straight down at their waist. Okay, it looks as if they were more tied when they were like that. Okay. I don't know for sure, obviously, I'm just speculating here, but that's what it seems like to me. Now, of this as well, two of the boys had black laces and one had white when they went missing. But we know that on two of the boys, they were found with mixed laces. So one had a white, one had a black. You know, the second one had a white and a black, and then the third boy had two black laces tying them up. Now, their clothes had been tied around sticks and shoved down into the mud under the water as well, as kind of a way to hide their clothing. It made it a little bit harder to be able to find them right away. So I think this was a way for the perpetrator to keep them hidden a little bit longer, and I think they were hoping that the bodies wouldn't have been found for at least a few more days. Now, as I said, their clothes had been tied around sticks and shoved down in the mud, and this is what hindered anyone from finding them that first time. Now, the clothing was also mostly turned inside out, and two pairs of underwear were actually never found. Now, I want to say something here as well. To me, this kind of makes it seem as if the boys took the clothes off themselves, or that they were forced off the boys. Okay. I'm speculating here, but that's just kind of what I would see. Because I watch my kids take their own clothes off, you know, when they're changing, and I see kind of how they do. A lot of times things come off inside out. But also, like, if I'm helping my youngest or if I'm helping a child, you know, a lot of times things come off, inside out as well. So just want to say that. Now, Christopher Byers, bless his little heart, was mutilated in the worst way, okay? This includes lacerations to various portions of his body, as well as mutilation to the genitals. The head of his penis and his scrotum were essentially removed. His testicles removed. You know, and all the skin around the penis itself as well. However, we're not really sure how much of this could have been at animal predation on the boys' bodies. Because there is the possibility there was wildlife in this area. Now, would they have done it so quickly? We're not sure. So that's something that's some speculation as well in the case. So we'll come back to that when it's mentioned. Now, the autopsies were conducted by forensic pathologist Frank J. Pietti, indicating that Christopher Byers died of multiple injuries, including the castration, again, which his scrotum was gone and the head of his penis was gone, as well as several stab marks around the area. Now, these pieces of his body have never been found. While Michael Moore, who received multiple bruises, welts, lacerations to the face, and Branch, with similar injuries to his head and face, as Michael Moore, but there were possible bite marks on his face as well. It was pretty brutal. You know, they had multiple injuries as well as drowning, as they had some water in their lungs. Now, initially, it was thought that the boys were raped and that they were, you know, tied the way they were to allow access for this sort of assault, you know, giving easy access to these sensitive areas where it gave them a chance to have their legs splayed, whereas a normal hog tie would have kind of kept the legs a little more together. It would have been a little harder to gain access to certain areas if it's a sexual assault. Okay. Now, after the autopsy, there were no major evidence stating that they were sexually assaulted. However, there were trace amounts of sperm DNA found on a pair of pants recovered from the scene of the crime. Now, it was determined by an expert used by the prosecution that Christopher Byers' wounds were a result of a knife attack, and that he'd been castrated on purpose by the murderer. However, there are recent tests done in the past few years, and I can't tell you the exact date. It may have been 2007, but it may be even later than that, by John Douglas. If you know who John Douglas is, he's a former FBI agent, that does a lot of criminal profiling. He's phenomenal. That man knows what the fuck he's talking about. Okay, I would believe him over a lot of other people, okay? He believes that the major injuries could have been postmortem injuries that were likely caused by postmortem animal predation, specifically by snapping turtles. Now, it's assumed that the boys were assaulted and killed at the location where they were found. However, there are critics who will argue that the assault must have happened elsewhere, as they didn't really find any blood in that area. Now, it comes out later that they did find a little bit of blood there on one of the banks, but that it would not have been enough to be, you know, responsible for the three boys' deaths, okay? Now, as far as toxicology, Byers was the only one with drugs in his system, but it was because he was prescribed Ritalin for his ADHD in 1993. In January. Now, this happened in May, so he'd only been on this medication for a couple of months. Now, they initially reported this drug as, excuse me for having to slow down to say this, but it's a long name. Carbamazepine, which is also considered for an ADHD drug, but that it wasn't in a high enough dose in his system to combat his ADHD. Now, they are saying that there's just a possibility that he might have forgotten to take his medication that day, you know, which happens with 8-year-old boys. You know, if you're not on top of it, they're going to forget. Excuse me. Now, it was also said that Officer James Sudbury and Steve Jones immediately started to question the idea of some sort of ritualistic or cult-type behavior in the slayings, and that they had immediately started thinking of the people who might be most likely to commit any sort of satanic rituals or exhibit this sort of behavior. Now we know that this is just some fucking total bullshit, because they're just looking for somebody really quick to blame. You know, this is in the Bible Belt. This is, you know, West Memphis, Arkansas. You know, it's a very spiritualistic, I believe Baptist, I may be wrong, but very small church-going community, okay? Very, like, things like this did not happen here. At all. So, for something like this to happen here, they had to think it had to have been somebody that didn't believe in God and didn't believe in, you know, whatever. So, very recently before this, Geraldo Rivera had put out a documentary about this underground satanic cults and Satan worship and all this bullshit. And I gotta tell you what, you know, back in the day, you know, I thought maybe he was a decent reporter, but when I look back, it was shock value. And that's what he used. It was shock value. It was something to get him some fucking ratings. Okay? Now, it wasn't long before they set their sights on a possible suspect. Okay? They go and look at this rebellious town teen. His name is Damian Eccles. Now, that was his... He had changed his name. I believe it was something Wayne Hutchison, and now it's Damian Wayne Eccles. He was 18 years old at the time, and along with Eccles was Jesse Miss Kelly, who was 17, and Jason Baldwin, who was 16. Now, Damian and Jason had records for being vandals around town and occasionally shoplifting. While Miss Kelly had a reputation for his temper. He had gotten into quite a few fights at school, and, you know, was really quick to get into a fight, you know, with somebody. But he was a little bit slow, okay? Now, Miss Kelly and Eccles were high school dropouts, and Baldwin was a pretty good student. He had great grades, he had a talent with art, and was encouraged by his teacher to go into graphic design. He had a lot of fucking talent. Now, while Damian and Jason were really, really close friends and listened to the same sorts of music, like Metallica, and a lot of heavy metal. They also had a, you know, a love for literature and, you know, did really well with that. Now, Miss Kelly knew them from school, but was really only acquainted with them. You know, wasn't really best friends, didn't really hang out a lot, but, you know, they were pleasant to each other when they saw each other, okay? Now, Damien was from a poor family that was familiar with the social workers around town. He barely went to school and eventually dropped out. Now, he and his girlfriend at one point run off together, okay? During this, there's a huge, huge storm, and they break into a trailer to seek shelter, but are arrested. And only Damien is charged with burglary, when really they just were trying to get out of the fucking rain. Now, it's noted that he was made to spend a few months in a mental institution in Arkansas afterwards, and due to this, he received full disability status from the Social Security Administration. It comes up later that, according to Dr. George W. Woods, he suffered from serious mental illness characterized by grandiose and persecutory delusions, auditory and visual hallucinations, disordered thought processes, and substantial lack of insight and chronic incapacitating mood swings. Bullshit. I call bullshit. I call bullshit. Jesse Miscalli was found, however, to have a very low IQ of only about 72 at the time, so he was easily manipulated into what happens next. Now, the average IQ of an average person is somewhere around 90 to 110. Okay? They say genius level is when you hit about 135 to 140 and higher. You know, higher IQs obviously, you know, are more expected with some of these types of things. But Jesse Miscalli was a lot slower, and you can kind of see when you see these interviews of him when he's very young. You know, and even today, he's just a very quiet, kind of reserved person. Now, today, I think it's because of everything that he had to experience with this. But that, I mean, he had his moments. He had his moments when he would talk, and he would say a lot, and he would, you know, but I didn't see him as any more than, like, just a troubled teen. I didn't see him as somebody scary or dangerous. Now, like I said, I find all this with these three boys to be bullshit. Damien Eccles is fucking smart as shit, alright? He's very, very intelligent. He's very well read, he's read a lot of books, and just curious about a lot of things. He was curious about religion, so he decided to read about all these different faiths. You know, whether it's Christianity, whether it was Judaism, whether it was you know, Hindi, whether it was, you know, whatever. He's looking at all these different kinds of religion and eventually gets a little bit of an interest on the occult. Mainly just because he was kind of curious about things. But just because that does not mean he killed these three little boys. Now, a woman in town even tried to frame them more when she reported that they were into Wicca and that she had been to a coven meeting. Now, if anybody knows about Wicca, it's more about the earth and nature than anything else. It's a druid or pagan start. Like, it's older than the Bible. It's older than Jesus. It's older than, like, so, you know, that's something that it was a paganism, druidism start to Wicca, okay? It's, you know, anybody who knows me and speaks to me on a pretty regular basis knows that this is something that has always, you know, encaptivated me. And, you know, so I have done a lot of research, and I would consider myself more pagan than I would Christian. Not that I don't believe it, or not that, you know, I renounce it or anything like that. It's just I resonate better with the relationship with nature as opposed to, you know, being told to do by a church, you know? So, and that's what it is. That's what it comes down to. You know, and that's how I look at things. Like, I acknowledge and I respect the earth, you know, and I do the same with my Christian faith as a Catholic. However, you know, this is older than that. And that's the only reason I'm really, really interested in a lot of this, a lot of that myself. Okay. So, but knowing that, knowing about Wiccan, the Wiccan religion, and knowing about paganism and Druidism and, you know, all of that, Damien even says in an interview that it was just an obvious choice to pick out these kids that stood out for being different because they wore a lot of black and listened to heavy metal and, you know, heavy metal t-shirts and, you know, they just looked different. He wore a trench coat, like he was just different. So it was an obvious choice to pick out these kids who just didn't really fit in with the rest of the community anymore. Now, it's important to share that there were two others that were suspects at one point, or at least questioned, okay? But they fled West Memphis very shortly after being questioned by police. So, two teens, also teens, okay, Chris Morgan and Brian Holland, both had drug histories and left for Oceanside, California only 4 days after the bodies were found. Chris Morgan was familiar with all three boys. He had actually driven an ice cream truck around those neighborhoods before. Now, they were arrested in Oceanside on May 17th of 1993 and took polygraphs admitted by the California police. Now, both reportedly indicated deception on their tests when they were asked about involvement in the murders. Now, I know before you say anything about polygraphs, this was early 93, like this was 93. Back then, they looked at polygraphs a little bit more than they do now. Now, they don't really use them so much in court because they realize that, you know, there are other factors that can kind of, you know, get in the way as far as reliability. But it's kind of a good indication that there's deception. Back then it was looked at a whole lot more. If they failed that polygraph, they were guilty. You know, I mean, it was, yeah. Now, both of these boys indicated deception on their tests, when they were asked about the involvement in the murders. Now, I want to say, like I said, you know, it may not be held high in court anymore, but it does show some red flags. It does show that something is not right. Did they just see something? Did they know about it? Were they part of it? You know, did you see something curious that maybe you should have reported on? You know, something like that. There's some red flags there. Now, during this questioning, Chris Morgan actually claims, you know, look, I've got a long history of drug and alcohol use, including blackouts and memory lapses. I don't know if I had killed the boys. Maybe I did kill the boys. But then immediately says, no, I couldn't have done it. No, I didn't do it. So they obtain blood and urine from the two boys, these two teens. However, there's no indication that West Memphis Police Department ever investigated them as suspects following their arrest in California. So these tests, this blood, this urine, whatever, that was sent back to West Memphis was never fucking tested? Never tested. Like, I don't give a shit if you think you've got a solid fucking case against somebody. If you've got tests to run, fucking run them. Better safe than fucking sorry. Fucking run the tests. I'd rather know 100% without a doubt than there be any question there, okay? Now, when we revisit the information now about Mr. Bojangles, okay, I mentioned him at the very beginning of the episode, that he was an African-American man who had been seen in a Bojangles, okay? Now, can we say, like, racist issue? Yes, it happened to be a Bojangles restaurant. But what the fuck are you calling him, Mr. Bojangles? Really? You know, talk about oh, some bullshit. Anyway, it's noted that around, I think it was 8:42, that it was he was seen in the Bojangles, okay? Very, very mentally disoriented, entered the Bojangles and entered the ladies' restroom. He had been bleeding and brushed against the bathroom walls. Now, Officer Regina Meeks responded to the call about this man being in there, but by the time she showed up, he was gone. This man had disappeared, okay? But what did she do? When she got there, what do you think she did? What would a typical cop do? You go in, you look at the scene, you talk to people, you get a full fucking report, right? She didn't do shit. She pulled up in the fucking drive-thru, took the statement through the drive-thru fucking window, and never went inside. It was like 2 days later, a day or two later, before anybody came and took samples from that fucking bathroom. 2 days later. So the manager, at this point, they'd found the bodies and everything. So the manager here, 2 days later, you know, thought, the manager thought, you know, there's got to be a connection here. The fact the boys had been found the next morning. The manager gives them, at this point, a pair of sunglasses that they found that they believe belonged to the elusive Mr. Bojangles. The detectives then, at 2 days later, take blood samples off the walls and the tiles of the restroom. Unfortunately, Detective Ridge lost those samples and scrapings. Detective Ridge was also the one that lifted those bodies out of the water. A hair identified as belonging to a black male was also later recovered from a sheet that was wrapped around one of the victims. Now, again, I have some issues here. Officer Meeks did not go in and look at the situation. She should have done that then. However, they knew that they were out looking for these little boys, and she had been out initially, you know, cruising around as well. She says something along the lines of jurisdiction, you know, whether or not she could handle it or not or something. But everything was in such close proximity. If she's the one that showed up, then she should have taken the full report. She should have, like, there's no documentation, like, there's no stuff except for the fact that they had called. She even testifies in court that she goes and looks at this place. Now, of course, the defense is saying, you know, no, you're just trying to come up with something to put the blame on somebody else because, you know, but no, it was these three teen boys. It's some bullshit. You know, there's a lot of things that were not done correctly, and I'll get into a little bit more detail of that here in just a minute as well. But the fact that they have a hair, you know, that belonged to a black male, that was never tested either. Now, apparently a probation officer that had worked with Damien did not like him. He was gunning for him straight out the gate, and therefore pushes him to the top of the list. But just because these boys listened to Metallica and wore black didn't mean they did anything bad, because if that's the case, they're going to be looking at me and a bunch of the people that I went to high school with. All right? I mean, they're going to look at the crowd I kind of wound up running with that was all just kind of outcasts and shit. Now, there were questions as to whether the boys were made to strip down, how one man could have done it, but I'm almost positive that these boys took their bikes down to Robin Hood Hills, probably took their shock socks and shoes off and left them on the bank of the creek to not get them dirty, like not get them wet. Boys did this kind of shit back then. Like, I was the same age. Those boys were born the same year I was born, okay? So they would be 36 years old, 37 years old this year. And I think personally, remembering being that age, like you could take your socks and shoes off, you go playing in the water. They might have stripped down to their underwear, you know, so that they could play in the water, especially if it was as hot and humid of a day as the police say that it was. You know, they probably just went to go get damp in the creek. But who knows? You know, I'm betting that this is probably what the boys did initially. I don't think they were forced into the woods. I think they went in there on their own free will. Now, they may have been stripped down to their underwear to play in the water, like I said. But the murderer probably found them like that. Took the shoelaces from their shoes and then approached them. Or got a hold of one of them, and then the attack ensued. I don't see it as being something that, oh, there's these three boys, let's strip them down and abuse them and beat them and do all this stuff and then just tuck them under here. I think it was more of a, hey, I got your shoelaces, I got your clothes, ha ha ha, you know, good luck finding them. So when they tried to come after them, like, that it was something that got out of hand and went further. I don't think it was necessarily something, the way it seems to me is that it was something that just went too far and with one of the boys, and they had to dispose of the others to get rid of eyewitness and evidence or something. That personally, that just kind of is what I feel in my heart. But again, I wasn't there. I don't know. I haven't seen all of the evidence. I haven't seen... There was a lot of differences in that crime scene, things that shouldn't have been done and that were, you know, it was just, it's a lot. So many days, almost a month after the boys are found, there's very little progress in the case or new evidence to point a finger at who might have done this, okay? So it's necessary at this point to mention that officers did question Damien on the 7th of May, and say that they gave him a polygraph, and the examiner said that it indicated deception. Okay, it is necessary to say this. Now, May 9th, during a formal interview, he mentioned the wounds to the genitals on one child, and the cops look at this as being very incriminating. However, this was something that was mentioned in the news, in the newspapers. This is not withheld information. This is something where they mention the day they find those babies, they say there may have been sexual assault. You know, there was sexual assault involved or something along those lines. You know, something is said about a genital mutilation. Okay, so yes, he had heard about it. So, of course, he's going to mention, yeah, I heard about that. That sucks, you know. This was not withheld information, people. So how can you hold that against him because he heard about it? Withheld information also is something that they usually look for in cases. If somebody says something that they did not report in the news, that they did not release to the media, and someone says, well, I knew about this, you know, purple sock when everybody else was wearing white, you know, whatever, you know, something, you know, I'm just pulling something out of my ass right now just to give an example. But if somebody says, well, I knew about, you know, this person had a cut on this bottom lip, you know, that looked like an L, you know, and they're going to be like, well, we didn't even release that there was a cut on his face at all, let alone his lip, you know, or the shape. So this guy either knows about it or saw it. So it's withheld information that they look for a lot of times. So when the cops decide to go and question Jesse Miss Kelly on June 3rd, so almost a month, he was not a suspect at the time. Jesse was just there to help incriminate someone else. Okay? So he knew both Damien and Jason. He knew they were best friends. And they just wanted to question him as a source of information. All right? They question this 17-year-old boy. He is a minor who is lacking in intelligence with a 72 IQ. He is alone. Now, granted, his father gives permission for his son to be questioned. However, he is alone. There are no parents. no nothing, no lawyer, nobody. He was questioned for 12 fucking hours. 12 hours. But when you watch or listen to the officers questioning Jesse, you realize really quickly he was so totally coerced. Absolutely influenced on how to answer. His story changed a multitude of times. And you'll see this in the documentary. It was overly obvious that this boy did not have anything to do with this. He often tried to remove himself from what they wanted him to say. Saying that he left, and then he left, and then he left. You know, of the 12 hours of interrogation, two segments, totaling in only 46 minutes, were recorded and entered into evidence. 46 minutes, less than an hour of evidence of interrogation, of the 12 hours of interrogation, was recorded. What the fuck does that tell you? This is unheard of. This does not happen. It is also stated that he was Mirandized. However, due to his issues with his mental capacity, with that lower IQ, he did not fully understand what it meant to be Mirandized. So there was an argument on this through his trial as well. Now, this is something I want to say about his interrogation. They go in there and they ask him, and you'll see this in the documentary, and I find this all really, really important, okay? They go in there and they start asking him questions. And, okay, well, you saw these boys go into the woods. You saw, you know, when was this? When was this? And he says, oh, about noon. Because before this, he's already told them he didn't have anything to do with it. And then it was, oh, well, you know, you got a phone call from Damien and Jason, so you went and hung out with them, right? What time was this? Like, they're starting to ask all these different times, and he's like, I don't know. Like, what do you want me to say, you know? So you hear him say, well, it was noon. We went out there at noon. Okay, well, so, but was it before or after school? Well, that insinuates it had to have been later than 12 o'clock if it was after school. So he says after school. You know, initially it's like, no, it was during school. Well, how was that? Because, you know, the boys were in school. No, they skipped school. You know, no, they were there. They were at school. So there was no reason that the boys would have been anywhere else at that point. Now, and then they go into, you know, okay, well, it was after, okay, so it was after school. So that puts it about 3-ish. Well, was it starting to get dark? So then he says it's more like 6-ish. And then it turns into 7-ish. And then it turns into like 9 o'clock. You know, I mean, it's his time is changing constantly, because they're constantly asking him and leading him to the answer they want to hear. It's absolute bullshit. Now, with that, I'm going to go ahead and end part one of this series on this case. I want you guys to think about that. I want you guys to hear, you know, the fact that this witness, supposed witness, and supposed turns himself into a suspect. Someone with limited and diminished mental capacity, with an IQ of a 72, that already doesn't understand shit, and you're going to coerce him into saying something that he doesn't really understand. All he wanted was to get them to shut up and leave him alone. And he thought if he did all this and he told them what they wanted to hear, that they'd leave him alone and he'd go home. He had no clue at all whatsoever that they were digging his grave and he was digging his own grave. They had no clue. He eventually incriminates both Damien Echols and Jason Baldwin, as well as himself. And then, of course, it's a matter of the cops proving that these three boys did it. So I'm just going to go ahead and I'm going to jump right into the next part of the case on another episode. So be ready for it. It's going to come sooner than you think it will. But it's definitely a case that I really, I can watch over and over and over, and I can read things over and over and over about this case because it's some fucking craziness, all right? So be ready because there's even more craziness to come. I'm only maybe a third to a halfway through my notes, so I don't know exactly how long this is going to be. It may turn into a three-parter, so we'll see how much I can get done. But I hope you guys are enjoying this, and I'll see you on the next half or next part of this episode. So we'll see you on the next one.